The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I am super excited for my next guest because if I put my list of people that were there in the early stages of me getting into wine, of being interested in wine, Angela Aiello would certainly be high on the list. And she's joining us now. Super wine girl, wine educator, wine writer, I'd say wine influencer. And I know the term influencer sometimes has bad connotations, but not when it is someone as talented as this. Angela, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Oh, Matthew, thank you for having me and for that amazing intro. I can totally understand and relate to why people sort of have those preconceived notions of the influencer side of things. I understand.
I blame Kendall Jenner. I'm just going to blame. I'm going to blame every Kardashian. That's what I'm going to blame for this.
No, I'm in complete agreeance with that as well. I think there's this sort of, you know, allure behind. It's more of a beauty allure, maybe leveraging your beauty a little bit more, or I don't know what the sort of the thing is. But I mean, being an expert or someone that, you know, people look up to, I feel like naturally this position has had to change, particularly in wine. And I think, it's definitely, I call this the sort of the democratization of wine, this idea that wine is no longer sort of a very elite crowd of people's conversation. This is an everyday conversation with a lot of people. And so I've seen, particularly this year, a massive increase in, you know, the conversations moving online about wine. And I think that's where the influencer conversation needs to really be highly regarded in a way where we're bringing diverse voices to the wine table, and wine influencers are, you know, in a lot of places, that's where they're starting.
Yeah. I think, you know, it has to be, we need the word educator and entertainer wrapped into one, because I mean, that's what you do. You're very entertaining and you make wine fun, but you're also educating people. If there's a way to make that a term instead of influencer, which has, you know, again, has these connotations where maybe it's just about physical aesthetic and not about everything else.
Yes, you're right. An edutainer, you know, in a way. You're kind of like educating and entertaining people in a way where learning is a byproduct of, you know, what everybody's doing. And I think wine really needs that. We taste. People taste. And I feel like along the lines, we're educating people about how to, I don't want to call it about premiumizing your palate, but it is. It's about understanding your style and building your wine confidence. And in order to teach people, you have to come into the world at their level and to be able to help people. And so it's very important that wine, I think, acknowledges that no matter how you're educating people, you have to be at where the people are. And so, I mean, this even comes back to, you know, more than a decade ago, when I started running the wine club and then also started bringing people to wine school classes where you had to walk down a very sketchy alleyway into a basement and learn about wine. And so it's, I think for me, I've always been about where are the people, who am I talking to and with, and how am I, how am I conversing? And then what are the methods or the communication tools I'm using to have those conversations?
Let's go back. Now, not as much sketchy, because I don't think Red's Tavern was ever sketchy, but the first time I ever met you, 2006, and it was the Aiello Wine Club. And 14 years ago, that was really the time when I started to get into wine, started to study it. I took it all the way, got my diploma from WSET and all that sort of stuff. But it kind of started there. And I was just wondering if you could take me back. What were those early days like for you teaching wine, Aiello Wine Club, all those years ago?
You know, it's 2006 seems like it's 14 years ago. It's hard to believe time flies when you're tasting so much wine. But you're absolutely right. You know, when I came into, so I graduated university in 2000 and I think it was five or even six, actually. I can't remember. It was five. And then moved to Toronto. I had no friends. You know, social media was just starting up there. So being social was like, you had to do things in person. And so I started the wine club as a way to sort of one, elevate my social, you know, circle in the city. Cause I grew up in the country. You know, there were a couple of us graduates who had moved to Toronto. And so we sort of got together and I had all this wine from working in wine country. And so that was really the link between me really building a social circle. And then the nice thing about it is I ended up working down on a retail store down on Queens Quay. Which was built actually more as a hospitality center around wine. And it was an Andrew Peller, it's an Andrew Peller Family Vineyards wine store. And we started to do wine events. I also started to see people really wanting to learn about wine, but there was nowhere at the time to learn. And so this is where sort of the wine club popped up. I sort of, you know, conjured an idea, started to program a back-end website and started putting people into an email system and started to connect with people, you know, through emails, throwing events and tours. And then we started, just like you said, the pop-up wine school classes started all over the city before we had an established venue, which happened, I think, back in 2013. So there was 7 years where we did pop-up classes and I met amazing people like you.
And it's crazy. And thank you for that. It's crazy to think about now how many wine schools and you know, there's, you know, the Quartermaster Somme, you know, there's obviously WSET and George Brown, and there's so many online stuff you can go. But back in 06, and this was before the Somme movies became famous, and I think this was even around the time when Sideways came out, but the difference when you got started versus now was just night and day.
Oh, I mean, 15 years has changed the entire world of wine. I mean, there was hardly any women in the business. There were hardly any young wine writers in the business. And there was definitely nothing online in the social sphere with wine. And so it was, you know, I feel like in a way it was sort of that game breaking time where I sort of trailblazed and sort of was, I don't know, maybe if I was the first person, but I was maybe one of the few first people sort of at a young age. I mean, I was 20, just under 24 years old, kind of going into an industry with no pretense and looking to being very excited about it and now wanting to change it even more. So I definitely sort of went in head first with a passion and a hobby project, which is what I Wine Club was for the first 5-6 years. And then it sort of, you know, skyrocketed into a full-time job. It expanded itself into so much more because you're absolutely right. The culture, the wine culture of the city just blew up. And I feel like, you know, we all know we've been bit by the wine bug, and there's lots of people that hadn't been bit by the wine bug. And now there's so many people that have. And so we all are different people. We all have different styles and different needs. And so you're absolutely right. All these different sort of communities have now emerged to give us a very strong wine culture here in Toronto.
Let's go to the idea of just how many women are in the business now versus then. And the privilege I've had as a guy is I never even really noticed or thought it was a thing. But part of that was getting into wine. Most of the people I was around were women. And I worked for a wine consignment company that was owned by a woman. So in my mind, I always thought, I never even realized, and this was how dumb and naive I was, that there was a massive gap. Obviously, I recognized there was a gap between the amount of women versus men in the business. What was that like in 06 and versus now, and how much better does it need to get?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think it's always nice to acknowledge some things that you never see before. I mean, the year that we're in is that acknowledgement and moving forward of sort of seeing things in a new light, the age of enlightenment this year for many different industries. And, you know, I was actually really lucky in the beginning of my career to fundamentally have some incredible women surround me and mentor me, like incredible. And many of them, actually almost all of them, are still in the business today. I still work very closely with them. And the mentoring that they offered me, which I, you know, took with everything, when a wonderful woman comes up to you and wants to help you and wants to work with you, I mean, the answer is always yes. And so in the beginning, you know, so I did so much, I don't want to call it free work, but it was work that you do to establish yourself. And, you know, maybe you were paid, maybe you were not, incredibly sort of develop your own credentials and your own resume. So I was incredibly lucky. I have and still have to this day, which is why actually I'm now part of a movement that helps mentor young women, because I feel like there desperately needs to be more women who offer their positive influence into this business. Because I mean, it's all easy. It's easy to be jaded. It's easy to not transform lives. But I think part of what being a good human is, being a humanist and being an activist in this business, is wanting to help change things positively forward. So I did see a lot of females sort of on the marketing side of wine. But I definitely saw within the wine writers circle, within, you know, an international wine writing circle, there was definitely a lack of female voices.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe I just had this weird stroke of luck where when I was at WSET, the most impressive person there was Emily Pierce. And one of the other people I was closest to, who's now at Fogo Island and, you know, in the East Coast, is Bree Demia. And Annette Brulee at Midfield Wine Bar is one of the best in the business. And Heather McDougall ran my favorite wine program for a long time at Montecito. So I was always surrounded, and I would sometimes joke, I'm like, where are the men in the industry? I feel like I was some sort of weird outlier.
I mean, that's such a wonderful story, Matthew. I feel like, you know, a lot of the women, all of the women that you mentioned have incredible pedigrees and reputations in this business. And, you know, Emily Pierce was the founder of Femme de Vin, which is a Canadian not-for-profit organization built to help elevate all women in wine, international voices through education, scholarship, and mentorship. And so you can see sort of those founding voices that you were so lucky to have in your life coming forward and also helping to change the business a little bit as well. I mean, it's true. I think there were softer, quieter women in the business back in the day. And now, you know, we're ready to talk. We're ready to be there. We're going to be front and center as well. And that's also a very positive thing, I think.
I was always upset at Femme de Vin, but for a very different reason. I remember the first couple of years of it, and Emily would show me the list of wines. And I'm like, what the bleep? I want to come in. Can I just sit in the corner? You won't even see me. Can I just try stuff?
Well, I know. I think the very first gatherings for that organization were at her house in the backyard.
Yes, they were.
And, you know, there were many different women. I think the first one, there were probably 50 or 60 women of all different age groups. And, you know, the commitment to helping each other was there. And I actually know this from quite a few women in this business that kind of have their own little women in wine communities that all help, you know, whatever way really works for you and your personality. I think we're all here to help each other. And I would hope that we're all here to help each other, regardless of gender, but also, like, you know, helping people with the proper talent to help elevate the industry.
Yeah, no, it's, yeah. I mean, everyone should be helping everyone, because in the end, this is supposed to be an industry of joy, an industry of where wine is used to help bring people together. So Angela, let's talk about you for a second. One of your monikers is Super Wine Girl. So what are your main wine superpowers?
Well, I like to say I'm saving the world one glass at a time, but really it's true. I mean, at the end of the day, I really want to help bring, I want to elevate people's wine confidence. And I think that's through very fun and educational and entertaining ways of communicating. And so I think, what are my superpowers? That's great. I mean, I could finish a bottle of wine sometimes a little too quickly.
we all have that superpower.
Yeah, I like my glasses to be very well polished and full of sparkles. You know, I definitely love a very nice, clean piece of glassware when I'm drinking great wine. I have been lucky enough to travel across the world. So, I mean, this year has obviously been a very different type of year. But and previously, I didn't even travel the world until I was 29. I've never been sort of outside of North America. You know, I've been to Florida for a family vacation, but really, I had never seen Europe until I was 20, 29 years old. And so just in the last, coming up to me next year, just in the last 10 years, I've been able to travel to 14 different countries and learn about wine. And so I have been incredibly grateful and thankful for wine being able to do that for me. Sort of like my little Super Wine Girl cape takes me around the world, you know?
Oh yeah, it's so cool the first time when you get to Europe or New Zealand or just other places to see different areas that make wine. But I need to go back to something. So you love the sparkle, you love the perfectly polished glass. How many times have you been out for dinner and your friends or family are like, "Don't do it, Angela, don't do it." And you put the glass up to the light and you've got a bit of a stink face on because the glass is not fully polished. Are you ever guilty of those moments?
100%. I think I would blame my 10 years working in the winery restaurant business where, you know, you spend late nights polishing glassware and you're taught to make sure every glass is perfect. And so now it's sort of it's my kryptonite 100% is to be at a winery or a restaurant and sort of notice a crappy looking glass and being like, I am investing in great wine and my glassware needs to follow suit, you know?
Oh, no, I fully get it. But I bet there's sometimes people at the table, friends or family, going, Angela, it's fine. Just don't do it. Just, you know, there must be those moments.
Oh, 100%. I mean, my mom used to do that when I tipped too much. You know, if I tipped too much, I would get sort of that family cut eye or, you know, if I ever make a stink about decanters is the other sort of kryptonite I have where it's like, you know, if I'm ordering great wine and you bring over a bad decanter, like I'm the first one to speak up and make sure that, you know, you invested better decanters for the wine or the proper decanters for the wine. I have like, you know, I definitely have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder for making sure that the great wine is poured into a great decanter. It's kind of like part of the job.
Hell yeah. Oh, absolutely. By the way, people sometimes don't understand this, but certain white wines should be decanted as well, shouldn't they?
100%. One of the biggest lessons I learned, actually, I was in Champagne for the first time and I was lucky enough to dine at Veuve Clicquot and they had decanted a sparkling aged vintage champagne. And I had one, never seen sparkling wine decanted, and two, sort of really had never seen white wine really decanted. And now, you know, obviously being in the business much longer now, I'm like, oh, that's such a great thing to uncover and discover. And no, I had that, you know, that wine moment at Veuve Clicquot, drinking vintage wine. I'll never forget that moment where I learned sparkling wine and white wine are decanted. And it's a lovely thing to teach people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be the full bodied shards, but it can be, you know, something from Moselle, Sauvignon. I think I always decant whenever I'm lucky enough to be drinking a good Sauvignon. Decant the white wine, people. It's fine. Angela, was your first TV gig a regular time on TV? Was it about 8 years ago, 2012, CHCH? Was it around that time?
Yeah, it was about that time, actually. My very first, it was CHCH was kind of following suit, but I did a CBC Stephen and Chris show for for 5 seasons or something. I was there and I was so young, I was doing home videos, YouTube videos at home. And next thing you know, the CBC calls you to be a wine host. And so I sort of learned how to produce segments and be on air on CBC and then over to CHCH has been my longest standing TV segment going on 8 years now.
So what I want to do, and it's great, and you do a fantastic job on it. But it's something like both of us who worked in TV and radio well over a decade, but 15. I mean, actually, for me, 20 years. Okay, now I feel old. Anyway, can you take me back to your first? Do you remember your first time or two on TV? Were you nervous? I'm always curious about people's first time when the red light goes on.
Oh, I mean, it's a nerve-wracking experience, especially on the Stephen and Chris show. They had a live studio audience, and so you were doing it sort of live in front of 50 people. I mean, CHCH is a little different because there's, you know, maybe 5 or 6 people in the room, so it doesn't feel as maybe you're presenting in front of all these people. But, you know, it's interesting, like you said, once you sort of get into the edutainment role, there's a lot of listening that needs to happen when you're on these types of situations. A lot of people like to go into these situations and talk, which is part of obviously what your job is. A very large portion of your job when it comes to hosting, and especially when you're hosting with people, TV or radio, is listening and finding space. It's not about consistently talking. You know what I mean?
Oh, God, yeah. Being a active listener is one of the number one rules I find when it comes to communicating, when it comes to be on radio. And it'd be difficult to do because often we're just waiting for someone else to be quiet so then we could just start talking again.
Exactly. And I think that, you know, it's in a lot of circumstances when I started with TV, you're there looking at somebody too. And so you're sort of like judging a lot of body language. And in radio, it's a little different. You know, usually you're on your phone or, you know, right now, at least in virtual, it's been a little different. But I remember the first time I did radio, I learned a lot about better speaking when it came to radio, because in TV, at least you're prompted a little bit, but radio is a bit different because you're not actually seeing people. So it's a bit of a different beast, but it's fun nonetheless.
Do you ever find, and I agree, I prefer radio because you have more time. You got more time to talk. You can breathe. You can explore. With TV, it's fast, fast, fast. Okay, we're going to have 80 seconds with this wine. Then we're going to have to move on to this one and then go here. And the host is going to throw to break. And it's just a whirlwind.
Agreed, 100%. There's definitely a more of a relaxed conversation that happens in radio, which I think is fundamentally almost like a bit, I think that's why podcasts are so, you know, great right now for people, is that you have that time to listen to a conversation. It's not a 5-minute segment where you're pushing out all these things, like you said, in 80-second increments or something.
Yeah. And one thing I've noticed, and I don't know, maybe it's because I've had a lot of guests on who have been on different TV shows talking about wine. The one thing I've noticed is that the host often gets intimidated by the wine and like, oh, what am I drinking? And you start to pour them something and they're nervous or they shrink back. Like, it's funny. Like, we talk all the time about how we try to make wine less intimidating. And I even see it on TV hosts that even they get nervous talking to you about wine because they don't want to feel like a fool.
Yeah. I mean, I think people are always scared about asking the wrong questions, right? And and making people feel comfortable in the fact that, you know, if you have that question, odds are other people have that question. It's like, it's a classroom scenario where, like, you know, everybody's scared to ask the question, but it's understanding that there's many people in the world with the same question.
And again, the one thing I'll tell everyone listening is the master sommeliers, the best at the business, they'll also tell you they'll never know it all. They'll never even get close. And on blind tasting, They're going to call a Carmenere a left bank Bordeaux. It's just part of the business.
I think you're absolutely right. The minute we all sort of just get grounded a little bit and release a little ego, is the minute we're all learning more and not afraid to ask. And also when we're free of judgment, judging other people. I mean, wine is full of judgment. People judge wines. Historically, wines are meant to be judged. And so I think people enter into this business or into the category of wine and immediately think they are also being judged by the questions that they ask, by their preferences in wine styles, by, you know, maybe their lack of knowledge. But for me, I think being wine curious is the most important aspect of people that we should be bringing forward. Like, you know, being people asking those questions that sometimes seem funny. And I've even felt, you know, intimidated sometimes being in those tastings with master sommeliers and you're like, oh, am I asking the wrong question? And so it really is about getting to a point where it's not about what people think of you. It's about what you're learning out of a situation.
So you're much nicer than I am. I can admit I shouldn't, because some of the people I'm watching are far more talented, hardworking, and spent more time in the industry than I have. But I have certainly watched a wine video going, how did you call that Syrah Pinot? Have you, and we're all like, you're a very good person, but has there been times, maybe you didn't say it outwardly, but inward, have you ever judged either what wine someone brought to a Christmas party or a blind tasting? Like, I can't believe they did it. Have you ever had those little evil moments?
Well, Matthew, I'm not a saint. So the answer to that is yes. But I do try in that moment to acknowledge sort of my ego. And, you know, I'd be like, okay, I just had a moment where I'm judging someone's wine choice. And it's true. You know, it's hard to sort of come back to that space of humility and honesty. But then there's also like the world has to be filled with authenticity too. And so things have to be authentic. And so, you know, I'm definitely, like I said, I'm not a saint. So I've definitely judged a couple people on their wine choices. But then I sort of laugh about it later when I come to terms with the fact that, you know, really at the end of the day, we all have those moments.
Okay, but we can agree on this. When you see someone with a seafood tower and they've got a glass of New World Merlot, you're allowed to judge.
I think I've definitely like judged pairings for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, there are classical pairings and I have got a very interesting way of looking at pairings too, in a very artfully distinct way. And I, you know, I also believe in the theory that you eat what you want, you drink what you want, it works out.
Absolutely.
But I have definitely, you know, judged someone and said, you know what? I think there's a better pairing that you might enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like anything different than what you have would be a better pairing. So I want to now mine your knowledge for the listeners. Value regions. Obviously, you know, if you're on a budget, you're not getting Burgundy, probably not going to Napa. So just like, what are value regions that you're enjoying right now?
Definitely. I think you're absolutely right. Right now there's a movement towards, you know, being adventurous in your wine choices, but also making, you know, great money decisions. We're in a time where we all need to make sure that every dollar that we're spending is, you know, important and also judged. So, you know, I've been really spending a lot of time in Spain these days with what I feel is a vast selection of choice and affordability for anyone enthusiast, from aged wines to very interesting, unique varietals to sort of, I always feel like I'm discovering a new Spanish wine region, which I love. You know, this morning I was just working on one of the regions and I was like, I'd never heard of this. So it was also very cool. So Spain to me is one of those regions that really offer, and even on the organic side, I mean, there's tons of organic wines from Spain, which is really quite lovely too. South Africa, I think, is another great region that offers fabulous Cabernet Sauvignon, Chenin Blanc, Syrah for, you know, a quarter of the prices of some of the New World wines that are out there. And Chile also has, Chile and Argentina have some incredible value wines.
Yeah, I definitely the South Africa. Like if you like the big Bordeaux blends or the big Cali, but you can't afford it, I would suggest there. Also, I don't want to go back to Spain in a second, but sticking on this, I know you know, you've been interested in Washington State. That's another area. If you want good Merlots, and also it's a little pricier, but some of the Syrahs, like Cayuse, there is some crazy good stuff in Washington State.
Oh, I call Washington State sort of the Wild West wine country, you know, like they have tumbleweeds that are rolling across the vineyards and like gorgeous volcanic soil and wonderful landscapes that create premium wines. And I think they're premium wines, but, you know, and they're premium price. They're a little bit more than maybe what you'd expect to say pay from Spain. But the quality is just astounding. And so I really do enjoy wines from Red Mountain or, you know, Walla Walla. You've got Horse Heaven Hills, Columbia Valley, some amazing regions that can pull out, like you said, some fantastic red wines. The Chardonnays are dynamite. And the Kung Fu Girl Riesling is sort of one of my go-to Rieslings now too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No. When I see that, absolutely. In terms of New World, Riesling, Kung Fu is near the top of the list for me as well. I want to go back to Spain for a second. And why should people try Rueda? It's an area I've traveled to. I know it's you've done some work, some stuff in the past promoting them. I'm just a huge fan of Verdejo and what that area brings. But I'd love to get your perspective.
Yes, I mean, indigenous grapes are such a great way to expand your love of wine and sort of dive into the books a little bit, the books and the maps. And, you know, Spain has a lot of very interesting sort of microclimates across the entire country. And Verdejo is such a cool grape. I really like it. It's sort of a, you know, I think someone told me or was describing it to me as a Pinot Grigio with that attitude. And I kind of laughed and I thought that's a great way to describe it. But it has sort of this crispness, this lovely acidity, this minerality or citrus that kind of lends itself well to amazing seafood dishes, whether you're cooking up mussels or freshly shucked oysters or, you know, shrimp and even lobster. It's a wonderful sort of way to elevate your at-home dining experiences with a very unique grape profile. But Rueda is a 100% a white wine growing region. And the wines coming out of there are just, to me, like they've got some spunk to them. They've got some lovability to them and they're super approachable in their price range.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You can get stuff for 16, 17. And also I find you can age them. Like I remember trying some of their more entry level, Verdejo wines and 5 years, they had just this richness and honeyness to them. And you talk about spunk. For me, it's like that finish. You can sometimes get that funky, earthy, sometimes fennel, or the expression they use that works is like a burnt brown butter. Like the finish of it, it'll leave you thinking sometimes.
I mean, I love that you brought that up because you're right. The winemaking techniques that can help really change a wine from its sort of original, you know, crisp freshness to something that's a bit more delicate, has sort of those honey aromas with those jasmine aromas with a little bit of like oak on it. So the minute you sort of take a white wine and you add the winemaking, you know, I always call them the toolbox of the winemakers with some interesting techniques, whether that's on yeast cells or lees or barrel fermentation with white wine. I mean, you can drastically change a wine and make it into an ultra lovable taste.
Oh yeah. Agreed. So in Angela, a couple more minutes with you. And again, I appreciate you joining the show. By the way, joining the show makes it seem like I'm doing my normal radio show. It's a podcast. I was almost going to do the radio reset, which is the dumbest thing in a podcast. If someone's listening, they're probably listening from the start to the finish. But you've tasted over 10,000 wines. This is always the hard question. I'm sure you've been asked 100 times, but of those, was there a couple that are the most memorable? And was there a couple that you were really excited about and just disappointed? And maybe it's not the winemaking. Sometimes you just get a bad bottle. But most memorable or most disappointing bottles?
That's an interesting question.
It's a hard one.
It is a hard one. I'm trying to think of a disappointing wine. You know, it's always disappointing sometimes when you have, I had this wine, I won't say the producer of it or the region, but I had bought a wine. It was pretty expensive. It was about $150. It sat in my wine rack for a while. I mean, it's probably my fault because my temperature control of my condo isn't perfect, for wine, but I remember being really excited to open it up and it being off. And it was a very disappointing moment. And it was a great bottle of red wine from New World. And like I said, it was probably my fault because I didn't put it into an actual fridge, but, a moment when you'd spend $150 on wine and then all of a sudden you open it up with that moment of aha and it's aw. But I did take it back to the LCBO and I got my money back. So that was the silver lining of that story. I mean, I remember having an aha wine moment in Washington, actually, where I had, you know, drank some Cabernet Sauvignon, but I was still really on the white wine train. You know, I liked Pinots. But I had never really like fallen for a red wine, and I mean fallen in love with a red wine. And I remember sitting at a winery in Washington State when I was there, and I tried a Cabernet Sauvignon, and I just remember my whole body sort of lighting up with this. You know, I was in love. I fell in love with Cabernet Sauvignon in Washington, and I had that moment in that region. And I just remember feeling like that was, you know, a really cool experience. And the same has happened actually when I was in the Mosel, you know, drinking Riesling up at the hill of Riesling in the town of Riesling. And you're just like, this is eating sausage. It's like one of those moments where you're just like, this is where it all makes sense. You know, where something about it, you've read all the books, you've had all the wines, but being somewhere where it happens is also a great feeling.
You're right. I'm jealous. Before COVID, my next big trip was going to be just renting a car and driving through Mosel, Rangau, Austria, Wacau. Like, that was the next trip, was going to be all about Riesling and Gruner. That would be just a gorgeous trip.
Yeah, you have those sort of wine moments, you know, they're very heroic in the memories because all your senses are sort of enabled. You're in a new place, you're tasting something, you're visualizing something. It has all those, you know, ways of sort of reminding you. And that's really what I've missed most about travel is that, you know, I've tasted a lot of wines, but at the end of the day, I've had my most memorable moments in wine country. You know, I was in Napa Valley when after the fires last year and I did a hot air balloon ride, and it was like moments that you will never, ever forget. Travel does that for me anyways. And I think for a lot of people. So that's definitely something I've been missing this year.
Oh yeah. No, I absolutely. I remember being in the North Island of New Zealand and, you know, at this place called Elephant Hill and right by the ocean and trying their first vintage they ever did of Chardonnay. And just, it was like one of those 3-hour beautiful lunches where you're like, this cannot get any better.
Exactly. I mean, New Zealand definitely does that, doesn't it? It's one of the most craziest places on the planet where the sun hits the world first. And it is what an amazing place to be.
It really is underrated. Everyone listening, if you can get wines from the North Island, not just don't worry about the Sauvignon Blancs, which are great. Get the Syrahs from Gimlet's Gravel from Hawke's Bay, and the Bordeaux blends from Waiheke Island are crazy. I don't want to end on a negative note, so I'll try to make this the second last question. How tough has COVID been, have you seen, on the wine world, on restaurants, wineries, consignment companies?
I mean, it has definitely put pressure on the entire industry. There are a lot of things in life that actually get better with pressure, say diamonds being one of them. But, you know, I think it has forced the industry to pivot in ways that it forced them to pivot now. I think there's a lot of people that have been telling the wine world, you know, we need to get direct to consumer, you need to get more digital. And so there's been a lot of talk around a lot of these changes. But I think COVID forced everyone to really have to dive into the industry now. I mean, obviously, our hospitality sector has been hit the hardest, and our chefs and our on-floor somms and our servers, back of house, front of house, everybody in the hospitality business, I have so much, you know, sympathy for, but also compassion for and love for in ways, because everyone from a career perspective also needs to pivot. And so not only is the industry pivoting, but people need to sort of adapt an entrepreneurial mindset more than ever in this day and age, with ideas on how to be creative and how to make money. And so I definitely think there's a, I mean, there's definitely room in the business for so much growth and excitement right now. So that's how I look at it, as a bit of a silver lining for our business. Even if there are sort of challenges and changes, I feel like there are many people who are still kind of have been hustling hard for the last 10 months to make sure that their business survives. And for the people who are sort of, you know, the world is forcing them to pivot, I feel like there's going to be some very interesting developments, very creative developments in our business. And that's really what these times in life, they challenge us to think differently. And as heartbreaking as they are to kind of go through, and it, you know, been challenging not being able to see anyone and have regular meetings, but I'm an optimist. So I'm like looking at a year in advance and going, oh, what is the world going to look like in a year from now? And how are people changing things for the better? And I hope to see a lot of really great come out of this.
I'm an optimist as well. To me, life is too short. At the very least, we now get single bottles sales in restaurants. That's here to stay. So that is at least one silver lining from COVID. So as we end this, Angela, what are you drinking now? And I was wondering if you could tell people just about where they can find you and just what is going on for you today and the future of Angela.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate that. I mean, this COVID world, the 2020 sort of brought me into a new career path as well, where I sort of didn't have any staff. I was a one-woman show, back to sort of my OG ways. I guess 2020 brought me back to 2006 and has inspired me to help develop new things for the industry, help be creative and help with creative thinking on different business models and whatnot. But, you know, I just had a girlfriend message me this morning, Angela, I need some wine. So can you help me out? And so I'm putting together a mix pack for her, you know, some of my favorite wines. So I've definitely seen my career shift into helping people, once again, super wine girl, you know, saving the world one bottle at a time or something, but helping people get wine to them in their house in a safe way. That has been a major shift for me. And then doing more writing. I've started as a drinks editor for Wonder Eater magazine. And then, you know, making sure my social media presence is always heavy, and that I'm actively messaging people back on every single platform in the world, from email to Facebook to DMing. I'm here to help with wine selections and to help get your palate sort of ready, or help with filling up your wine rack. There's lots of fun ways that, you know, you can call on me, I guess, is me.
And if people are going to, what's the best way to contact? What's the best way to get to hold it? I mean, like, I imagine is it like the Batman style where they put up, you know, a large A into the sky and suddenly you swoop in with a good bottle of Riesling? How do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, following me on Instagram is probably the easiest way, if you're on Instagram, or my email is ask@superwinegirl.com. So if you have a question about wine, you can just ask Super Wine Girl. Then my website is up and ready. It's angelaiello.ca or superwinegirl.com, sort of in the midst of a rebrand right now that'll happen in the new year. So lots of great ways, you know, to find me.
Angela, I really appreciate this. This is an interview I've wanted to do for a while. I've been a big fan ever since taking classes with iYello back in 2006 at Reds. And so I appreciate you taking the time. I'm happy for your success, for your pivot. And you're someone that I have confidence in, that no matter what happens, you will always land on your feet.
I appreciate that, Matthew. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me today. It's, you know, our relationship means a lot too. It's been a decade or more since we've known each other. And so, you know, I'm very interested in what you're drinking right now.
Right now, let's see. What do I got going on? Actually, a lot of Bordeaux white. I got to tell you, it doesn't get as much love because we stick to Bordeaux red or Burgundy white. But just the spiciness of that Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon blend, Bordeaux whites are something I've really been getting into.
Amazing. Well, I wish you all the best over this holiday season and into the new year, and look forward to seeing your face soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Take care. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.